Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We have a fine guest that's going to give us a special report from England, from the UK, from the Bristol area. We want to welcome Tony Gosling. Welcome to our program, Tony.
Hi, George. Lovely to hear from you again.
Boy, I tell you what, y'all had quite a festival over there at the Bilderberg. Tell us a little bit about that. What happened?
Well, I'll tell you what, George. I mean, I know it's about a month or so ago now, but it was almost tear-jerking for me to be back in Versailles back in 2003 with three of us stood on the street corner with a camera and a notebook, a video camera, and to turn up in Watford back in June this year, here in Britain, just north of London, to find 2,000 people sitting in a field waiting to hear me speak and tell them about the Bilderbergs. Now, I mean, absolutely wonderful and beautiful weather we had. The other thing is we had a traditional English narrowboat barge chugging up backwards and forwards through the grounds of the hotel the Bilderbergs were using, with Alex Jones on his megaphone, his bullhorn, telling them what was what, and we really had a fantastic time. The other thing is that there was actually quite a lot of coverage in the UK mainstream media. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners have made the connection, but I certainly have, and that is that the Saturday of the Bilderberg conference here was the day that a certain Edward Snowden popped his nose up in Hong Kong and started handing over data about the secret spying system of the NSA and how British GCHQ over to the press. And I think that is not lost on the Bilderbergs by any means, because of course it's them, and to a large extent the military-industrial complex people, arms manufacturers, the bankers, people like that, who are actually profiting from this kind of crazy surveillance system and also pushing it within the establishment. So it looks to me, and I mean, I don't think this is unfair to say, that we've got a bit of a war breaking out within the intelligence services and within the establishment in the Western world. And some of them are prepared to say, and Edward Snowden is obviously representing them in the world's press, we've had enough of this insane obsession with secrecy and control. And unless you start treating your citizens as citizens, and that is to say in a democratic United States, a democratic Britain, and a democratic Europe, that your days are numbered. And I think that there is no coincidence that the whole Edward Snowden thing blew up actually during the Bilderberg conference to send a very clear message to the Bilderbergers that actually on the outside was where it was all happening, not on the inside of the conference.
Right. Just this morning on ABC News This Week, it was revealed by Greenwald, who has been exposing some of the Snowden deal, that our FISA court did a report, an 87-page report, in 2011, and in that report it states that the operations of the NSA are both unconstitutionally and illegal, what they were doing, had their past activities. But the Congress has asked for that report, and the Obama administration is refusing to provide that to Congress.
Well, this is what I mean, I suppose, about a kind of breakout of a bit of a war going on in the establishment here,
yes,
here in the West. I mean, using the word war is actually not necessarily an understatement, because I think for many years now, the different sides have been sort of rounding up against each other and sizing each other up. And I think over this surveillance issue, this looks like it actually may break out into some serious, you know, I'm not talking about actual physical fighting. I'm talking about here is a wars of words and also of sackings and resignations and this kind of thing. Now, if the White House and the Congress want to go head to head, George, I will put a question to you. I know you're supposed to be asking me the questions, but who would win such a battle?
Boy.
Well, I would imagine, actually, that the Congress will win, because I think...
Congress has to originate spending bills, okay? And right now, the Republicans control the House. The spending bills have to originate in the House. So they could blackmail Obama into a budget, non-budget, you know, push him to the brink there. You know, but the president has been really doing some high pressure, and also he has more prosecutions of whistleblowers than any president or accumulation of presidents since.
I think it's also interesting to look at the backdrop of what's going on in the Middle East right now as well, isn't it? I mean, fascinating
yes,
to see
yes.
the failure, really, of the Free Syrian Army with all the massive support it's getting from all the NATO countries and the Israelis to actually crush the Assad regime. Now, I don't know what the situation is over in the US, really, amongst the sort of gossip mongers in Washington, George, but certainly here, we're getting the message that the British military are saying to the British government, OK, that's enough on Syria. They're seeing quite clearly that the superpowers are sizing up in the country. And whereas they were more than happy to wade into, in covert by covert means, etc., into Libya to remove Gaddafi, they are now, the military here, are saying to the politicians and to the press, quite clearly, this is enough. If we start committing our soldiers into this particular battle, and even just supplies to the rebels there in Syria, that we are crossing a line which may draw our forces in to a battle that they can't win.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, basically, because of the way that the Russians have actually very cleverly backed attack using effectively fairly innocuous missile systems, that is to say, they're defensive, not offensive missile systems, these anti-ship missiles, etc., anti-aircraft missiles, what they're saying is, you know, we are actually going to arm Assad to the teeth with defensive munitions in order to make sure that he can win any kind of battle that you decide to take to him. Now, that's going to be very, very clear to the American public and the British public what's going on. If we're surrounding Assad, along with the Israelis, with our naval equipment, and we are in any way assaulting Syria, and we start to see our aircraft carriers going to the bottom of the Mediterranean, your aircraft carriers, Britain doesn't actually have any actively at the moment, and our ships going to the bottom of the Mediterranean, this is going to send a very, very clear message to the British public and the American public that we've taken on and bitten off something here that we can't chew. I will also point out that we've got these German-made Dolphin-class submarines which are floating around in the Mediterranean, which, you know, for many of the public didn't even know that this fleet was there. Now, they're firing missiles from underwater, some of them, actually out through the surface of the Mediterranean and hitting targets in Syria with their fingers crossed, hoping that nobody knows that these submarines have actually done these attacks. And the reason they're hoping that, of course, is this, this is a primary war crime. The Israelis hitting Syrian soil, doesn't matter what they say they're doing, that is actually violating the UN Charter, and they're trying to open up a new war. But they're trying to do it in this incredibly sneaky way, not telling anybody that this war is being started. And then also when the US contacts the Sunday Times, and Rupert Murdoch here in Britain publishes information saying that it was actually these Israeli submarines that launched the attack in July against Syria, against the ship missiles, which is subsequently found that most of the ship missiles that were in this warehouse had already been moved, the Israelis are getting very, very annoyed because the Americans and certain people in the US and in Britain are actually leaking this to the international press. So it's a very clear message going to Tel Aviv right now that if they try and try these sneaky tactics to get a Middle Eastern war started where without the blame being pinned very, very firmly on them, they're simply not going to get away with it, George.
Right. That's good analysis. I did a paper recently on Egypt and then one before that on Turkey, and it looks like the Egyptian situation, of course, is controlled by the military, but I also uncovered the fact that between 20 and 35% of the Egyptian economy is owned by the armed forces.
Yeah, isn't it interesting the way the whole thing is transpired in Egypt, I think is fascinating.
The military, the armed forces are not going to let any president make large enough reforms to encroach upon their absolute rulership of Egypt. See, that's the
problem. Now, it seems to me what's going on there, and I'm not clear about who's paying these mercenaries. I don't know if you saw when we had that massacre last week in Egypt, that actually the people were being killed not by the Egyptian army, but by snipers who were on the roofs, who were unidentified, who didn't appear to be in any way, and in fact, by the mention of some of the Egyptian army commanders, they're surprised. I mean, what they were doing was trying to be, I think, on the ground, the Egyptian army trying to be fairly fair-minded with the demonstrators, treating both of them reasonably. Obviously, they've got much more sympathy with the anti-Morsi demonstrators than the pro-Morsi demonstrators. But the actual killings were done not by the soldiers on the ground. They were done by special units of unspecified, unknown about, but it seems by the army commanders on the ground in Egypt. But the question has to be,
right,
and this hasn't really been asked in the international press, who was paying these snipers to snipe into the crowds in Egypt? Because it seems whoever it was is trying to start another Syria off in Egypt, to start,
yes,
some kind of civil war there. All that's lacking is the fact that actually the Egyptian people, I think, en masse, are very much aware of these kinds of tactics to try and get one side fighting the other side on the streets of Egypt. Egyptians, poor Egyptians, killing other poor Egyptians. And I think that the Egyptian people are actually quite wise to this, George. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Well, I believe that the military, of course, is on the secular side of, you know what I mean, the political spectrum. And also, Morsi made some mistakes last November in trying to issue these presidential decrees, and I think he lost support within the Muslim Brotherhood also. So he made some major mistakes back in November, and they started pouring out into the streets then. But I think the army has mobilized this secular revolution, and it's to their advantage to get rid of Morsi to justify an ousting.
You know,
of
what would be the absolute litmus test of the army whether we see an instant expectation, a very fast program towards a fresh election, and we haven't seen that. We've heard a bit of talk about it, but there certainly isn't any real interest, it seems, by the army to do that. And so I think, unfortunately, this is going to go badly. It certainly is a military coup, despite what the British and the Americans officials like to say about it. You know, got news for you guys. That was a military coup we had. The ultimate question here is, you know, can Egypt again wrest itself from the military power, which was, of course, in the old days really represented by Mubarak? And unfortunately, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood, which seems to be the main alternative, is, of course, an organisation which was constructed originally, mostly actually by MI6, by the British Intelligence Services. And the question is, to what extent is the Muslim Brotherhood, certainly at grassroots, it's a very, very grassroots Islamic party, but at the top, to what extent at the top is it actually being manipulated and controlled still by Western intelligence, George?
Yeah, it is a mystery. But right now, Morsi actually had a chance to establish a very moderate government, but he just ran too fast. He moved too quickly, and then starting to issue those presidential decrees in November did not help.
The trouble is, George, if he didn't move fast enough, people would also criticize him. You see, I mean, it's almost like a no-win situation. I mean, I don't know if you would like to be the president of Egypt, would you?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, he was cozying up to this international and acquiescing to the payment of
those
loans, too. And that's where the IMF moved in under Mubarak, see? And open, they were trying to open up Egypt to a greater foreign investment. Now, that was actually against the armed forces.
Well, there were also moves by Morsi to actually get the Egyptian army involved in the Syrian conflict, and there was a lot of pressure there. And one of the other things, of course, that happened as soon as the military coup happened, which a lot of people seem to have passed by the wayside, is the closing of the rescue tunnels into Palestine from Egypt. I think it's the Rafah border. You know, this is one of the first things that happened as soon as the military coup happened, that they decided to close those. And I mean, the thing is that, you know, it's really an absolute lifeline to the Gaza prison camp through Egypt. And the army really has to show its solidarity with the people behind those prison bars if it's going to have any kind of real credibility into the future.
Now, what's interesting is to Monday they're going to announce some decisions on the Ergenagin scandal, which had to do with the secret societies. Boys were coming in there and doing assassinations and stuff. And there's supposed to be some announcements this next Monday in Turkey. That totally was coming from the secular military side of the coin, the political coin. And I just don't think, I don't know what these results of these courts are going to be. They had to actually create those courts within the special areas of the prisons that they were holding many of these prisoners at. They couldn't gain security for those courts outside those walls. So they actually started creating these court systems within some of these
We're certainly getting some pretty frightening signs, though, that some kind of false flag attack may be getting closer, or some sort of war in the Middle East may be getting closer, George. And I think those are really, really important.
Oh, right, right. Yeah,
one
right.
is this alert over the weekend, unspecified. There's been several particularly nasty drone attacks with innocent people being killed this week in Yemen, which might be may have been the reason for some kind of threat against the US or the Britain or the Israeli. The thing is, right. you know, we've got this horrendous little triumvirate, haven't we, of the drone makers, the drone lovers, the murderous drones
right,
from
right.
the air, which is the United States, Britain, and Israel. And actually, Israel is by far the greater user and manufacturer of these drones, rather than even from the US and Britain. I mean, it's actually quite scary to think you've got three countries on Earth that think that they can fly these little remote control planes around and kill anybody at will, anywhere they want to. And it only seems to me, unless we nip this in the bud right now, a matter of time before those drones start flying over our countries and killing innocent people down our street. And it, you know, we really have to identify those three countries as being at the heart, I think, right now, of the problems in world politics. The other thing, George, really important to mention, this was a bit of news, is the close down of the access for Press TV, the English language Iranian channel, to their YouTube account. The YouTube account hasn't itself actually been closed by Google, but they have actually stopped access for Press TV to their channel. So there's been no uploads of the news in English from Press TV onto YouTube at all for the last week. YouTube sending regular little updates on, they're sending no updates, YouTube. Press TV every few days put another update onto the Press TV website about what's happening with this. They've got no reply, no explanation from YouTube. I don't know what the situation with Press TV is in the US, George, but here, Press TV's been banned for something like 18 months. Nearly 2 years now, on totally spurious grounds. The Freeview channels, the digital channels here in Britain, have been blocked from carrying it. You can still pick it up on some of the satellites, but the European satellites are also blocking it now, and some of the big multinational-controlled Eutelsat and Intelsat satellites have also blocked Press TV. So even though we've got actually quite a good English-language channel coming out of Tehran, which is actually, they had London offices and other offices around the Western world. This has been now totally blocked from being watched on the internet. I mean, we can read their news still on the internet, but we can't watch their English language TV programs, which were very popular on YouTube. And I think that's a very significant that Google have decided to block that.
Well, Al Jazeera is still crunching.
Yeah, but the thing is, Press TV, I think, is a much more edgy program. You know, to me, it was saying, for example, we had Gordon Duff in there quite regularly. There were all sorts of very interesting characters who you never see popping up on our TV screens on the mainstream news anywhere in the Western world. And the Tehran and Iranians were making sure those voices were at least being heard, even if they were sort of via a country far away, and that people could access them. Now, with Google moving, you know, almost as if it's just a little limb of the American intelligence services, to close that down and giving no explanation whatsoever for it. So I'm afraid Google's friendly image is crumbling as the US and Israeli and British and NATO push for some war in the Middle East gets a little bit closer.
Right. We had revelations just in the last few days about Benghazi. There were a couple of dozen CIA operatives on the ground. There were many more injured and wounded than they ever reported. And now they're putting a lid on that and changing those people's names and moving them around the country. That's the latest scandal.
Well, I know one of the other things that you like chatting about, George, is some of the background in World War II of what's going on now. And it's been another revelation from a British journalist who is in Buenos Aires, Lawrence de Mello, L-A-U-R-E-N-C-E, Lawrence de Mello. She's been tracking down Martin Bormann, and when she first arrived a few years ago in Buenos Aires, she was told about, you know, you always got to watch out for the Nazis next door around here. And, of course, it's still going on over there. What she's done, though, is she has actually discovered a photograph she believes is the daughter of Martin Bormann, who's now something like 50s, who was born in 1953. So the idea that Martin Bormann died at the end of World War II, I know we, you know, many of us are very, very sceptical about that, particularly with the Flight Capital Network and Bormann setting up these 750 corporations, you know, the Nazis taking off their swastikas and their SS badges and putting on suits and then marching around the world as corporate directors into the post-war world. That's looking as if it's even more solid now, that Bormann certainly did survive the war and was living under Argentinian police chief protection in Buenos Aires. And she's interviewed a guy who's she's now able to use the interview, because he said when she interviewed him that he only wanted her to use the interview after his death, because he was so worried about what would happen to him or his immediate family if the interview was aired while he was still alive. And so she's now got permission to use that interview. And he was a senior police officer in Buenos Aires in the 50s and 60s. And yeah, he was in charge of protecting Bormann and making sure he had everything he wanted. He had a whole squad of, you know, sort of lowly police officers that would run around Buenos Aires for him so he didn't have to show his face on the streets.
Right. Gerard Williams has a movie out called Grey Wolf. And they premiered it at the Berlin Film Festival, and I think it's being screened there.
That's
in
right. See, I'm actually very skeptical about this Grey Wolf book, because I think what happens is quite often things are put out which aren't necessarily the case. I would, on the whole, what happened with Adolf Hitler is another whole other question. We know Hugh Trevor Roper was sent over to make a cover story because Stalin, into Berlin, because Stalin was saying the British are protecting, the Americans are protecting Hitler. I think what happened personally was, and Peter Lavender is really the person that I would point you to as one of the best sources on this. I mean, he really does seem to be an expert right on the origins of the Nazi Party and the Theosophical Society and all this kind of thing through his excellent book, Unholy Alliance, and his trips to South America where he came across these Nazis. But what he's essentially saying is that, yes, Hitler went to Argentina and South America initially, but what was happening was there were plenty of ex-Nazis over there who actually wanted him dead and were giving him all sorts of hassle. They actually didn't like Hitler anymore because they were really bitter about some of the selfish decisions that he'd been making during the war. So it was decided to scoot him out to an island over in Indonesia, and he lived out the end of his life there disguised as a doctor. So, you know, that's the latest that I know, and I would suggest that's if it. People want to track down, they get hold of Peter Lavender and some of his latest work.
Okay, this Martin Bormann.
I certainly am, and you know the other thing is Lawrence. That was
Paul
brilliant.
Manning,
there is
Paul
a follow-up
Manning,
book
that's
today,
a very,
course,
very...
and that is called Op JB, and that book really explains, and it's by one of the British military officers in the army who was in charge of the operation to actually get Martin Bormann out from Berlin, out from under the noses of the Russians, and another person involved in that operation of MI6, M section of MI6, was Ian Fleming, the famous author of the James Bond novels. And I think, you know, what we've got here is a situation where people have been involved in massively important covert operations in the Second World War, but they're told very, very simply, you're not allowed to ever speak about this to anybody, and if you do, you'll be under the Official Secrets Act, you will be jailed. But what you can do is you can write fiction, and this was the driver, I think, for Fleming to then go on and write his James Bond novels. He was writing about the sort of stuff that he'd seen in World War II, but in a fictional context, and also he rather cheekily used the name James Bond to describe his hero, because this was a clue, really, to look at Operation James Bond for real back in World War II, which was Martin Bormann had the code name Piglet, and various of them went over to Berlin right in the closing stages of the war, and with commandos, some of whom were actually Jewish Germans who had come to fight for the English, and they didn't realise that they were actually getting Martin Bormann out because he was wearing a mask. But this book, to read all about this, is written by Christopher Crichton. His real name is John Ainsworth Davis, but he had to use a pseudonym when he wrote the book back in the 1990s. And it describes that operation. It describes all sorts of other stuff, fascinating stuff, I find, one of which is the destruction of a Dutch submarine, by Christopher Crichton, John Ainsworth Davis himself. He actually visited the submarine, gave some presents from the Dutch royal family to the submariners, and then left them. The only thing was that those presents were actually bombs, explosives and poison gas to kill all the submariners. Because what had happened is that submarine had radioed through the location, the exact bearing and the speed of the Japanese fleet as it was heading through to Pearl Harbor. And he was sent to make sure every single member of that crew perished, so that none of them could testify that there had been a four-day warning before Pearl Harbor to make sure that it was still in history seen as a surprise. So there's all sorts of interesting stuff in that book, and the book is Op JB. It's only a couple hundred pages, a fantastic read. I don't think it's ever been published in the United States, though. You have to get it, I'd imagine, shipped over from Europe or from England in paperback or hardback.
Are you familiar with these Gestapo Chief books or that came out, Gestapo Chief?
Yes,
Mueller,
he's not talked about in the Op JB book, because that's about the operation to get Bormann out. I mean, what they even did, I was gobsmacked to read this, George, is they actually had a British person who was picked out, who looked very much like Bormann, and they had a British Secret Service operation for other Secret Service people to follow, thinking it was Bormann, down to Switzerland, but it was all a ruse. The idea being that then the real mission to get Bormann out, none of the Secret Service would know what was really going on. I would really recommend that. And the actual author is Christopher Crichton, but his real name, which has come out since, is John Ainsworth Davis. He was part of M Section, which was being run by Desmond Morton, who was very close to King George VI and Churchill. And so this M Section was a very secret part of MI6 during World War II. So all the top people knew this was going on, just a handful of them. But even some of the other senior, the senior staff officers of all of the forces didn't know anything about it, just a handful of this hand-picked intelligence team. And the reason that John Ainsworth Davis has written this book, Christopher Crichton has written this book, is because he felt so utterly betrayed afterwards to find that rather than getting Bormann out in order that they could get the British could get their hands on this German looted money and then redistribute it across Europe, all they did is they wanted it for themselves, and they were actually aiding the Nazi Party in reforming the New Reich. So he made sure that this book was published and written before he died.
How much of that Nazi money that Bormann seeded into these corporations? How do they have a stake in many of these?
Well, they certainly do. One of the things I noticed in that book, George, is the what popped out. One of the things that popped out to me is the Wallenberg family in Sweden. I mean, we all like to think of Sweden as being a very neutral, free country, and everything's kind of cool there. Well, actually, look at the Wallenberg family. They had one of the brothers was pro-Nazi, the other brother was pro-Allied. They made sure that whatever happened at the end of World War II, that at least one of them was going to be able to carry on the family business and keep all the loot. But then they appear in Manning's book as money launderers for the Nazis at the end of the Second World War. But then they also appear, don't they, at every Bilderberg conference still. So one does wonder whether Bilderberg really does represent a financial forthright. Big corporations like Hitler used to use.
Well, you know who originated?
A massive bank with fantastic amounts of money for a hostile takeover.
You know who originated the Nobel Prize in Economics?
Yes,
the Central Bank of Sweden. in the 60s. And they did that to give credence to the financial operation.
Yes, I think it sort of lost its credibility, the Nobel Prize, hasn't it? Some of the people that have got it. I think once Henry Kissinger got the Nobel Prize, the credibility of that particular gong went right downhill. In fact, I would imagine there were several people that thought of throwing in their gongs.
Exactly. Yeah, right. And the Peace Prize has been awarded in Oslo because my understanding is that Norway and Sweden were at peace at the time, so the Swedes allowed the Peace Prize to be awarded, the only one to be awarded in Oslo. And so that's a little bit of a, you know, insight there that I've gained over the years. But the actual Nobel Prize for Economics was created by the
central
bank.
The other thing is we've got a new governor since I last spoke to George here in the Bank of England. That's Mark Carney. Mark Carney, everyone's being told, is somehow from the Bank of Canada. Nonsense. He's from the Bank for International Settlements. He has been on the board for many years of the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland. He's also on their policy-making committee and their regulation committee, the two most powerful committees of any kind of bank. Well, I mean, is the central banker's central bank, the BIS, anywhere in the world. So Carney, what an interesting chap he is. I mean, he struts onto the stage as if he's some kind of sort of superhero. And he talks about, we've got some new notes which have got Jane Austen on them, and that seems to be his public relations position in front of the public. But actually, the guy's working for a bank, BIS, which helped finance the Nazis in the 1930s, that provided Hitler with limitless amounts of foreign exchange during the Second World War. And after the Second World War, it was Henry Morgenthau, I think, from the US, that put forward the resolution at the Bretton Woods Conference that the BIS must immediately be closed, as it had been a bank which had funded the Nazis and enabled them to carry on trading all around the world with all the neutral countries with impunity, getting all sorts of goods that otherwise they wouldn't have been able to get hold of. So that was passed successfully, and yet the bank still exists, even though at the Bretton Woods Conference the resolution was passed almost unanimously to close the Bank for International Settlements. It's still there, and Mark Carney is its latest incarnation. Now, I like to think of him as a bit of a Dracula, I'm afraid. If he's coming from this bank which funded the Nazis, I don't want him in charge of our currency. I don't think anybody in Britain, if they knew it, would want that either. And so the other aspect of all this, of course, is as it's the central banker's central bank, the BIS, where they all meet once every 2 months and possibly more often than that, these are the people who are responsible for the mess, the financial mess we're in. And they talk about it as a financial crisis, George. Well, it's only a financial crisis for the poorest 99.999%, for the top 0.01% of the population. This is not a crisis at all. It's a bonanza. They're doing incredibly well out of it. And, I mean, here in Britain, we just had the figures. From 2008, the 1,000 richest people in Britain are now, each of them, every single one of them, roughly £140 million each better off. So they call it a financial crisis? No.
Yeah.
Actually, for the elite, it's a super bonanza. And the other thing, of course, is the banks are wandering around committing all this money laundering, the LIBOR fraud, payment protection insurance fraud, interest rate swap fraud. The city has become the central crime gang for the world's money launderers. What they're getting is they're only getting piddling little fines, silly little fines, which don't even represent sometimes 1 week of 10 years of fraud. What happens whenever they get these fines, nobody, of course, is going to jail, none of the traders, none of the directors of these banks. When they get one of these fines, you see the share prices of these banks leap. I mean, RBS went up 8% the day that they announced the LIBOR fine for them. And so, quite clearly, the investors are happy, very happy, that they're getting these very, very tiny fines, no jail sentences, no questioning of any individuals in the bank. And it's only very recently that we've had the LIBOR fraud expert Rain Man, this guy Tom Hayes, arrested in London, and still, you know, no trial in sight for him. But he, in a way, he is a sort of fall guy, because even though he was doing the trades, he was being hired and fired with full knowledge of what he was up to by the directors of these banks and by the senior management of these banks. And they're the ones that should be in the dock.
Well, you know, right now, without the Federal Reserve System here, they wouldn't be alive over there or anywhere, whether it's UK, European banks, or American banks. They keep crediting them with this quantitative easing.
Well, the quantitative easing
pumping the money out.
And all the money is going away from the real economy into the fictional economy. The asset price bubble is going to go up and up, and at some point it's just going to go bang. So quantitative easing is a rather pathetic way, really, that any self-respecting economist would really walk in the other direction from. It is really the lowest of the low way of kicking the can down the road a little bit further, and also feathering the nest of the rich whilst impoverishing the poor. I mean, this is really an appalling state of affairs, and I can only say it must be surely the end of capitalism now, George.
Right. Well, Tony, I appreciate you being with us tonight, and we certainly, boy, those insights you have are wonderful. And I'll never forget that interview you had with old Luke Rakowski over there. Boy, he was astounded.
That was great, wasn't it? It was lovely. It was the first time I've met him.
You
and Lotus,
I mean, you and Lotus.
Fantastic time to meet him, and a brilliant occasion.
I know, Luke. Yeah, Luke is a great guy, and you unloaded on him. I don't know how long that interview was, but
we've got a sort of almost equivalent over here in Britain of Luke, and he's called the Artist Taxi Driver. You can look him up online. And he's basically a London taxi driver who usually for a few days every year, maybe one day a week or whatever, he'll get in his taxi, and rather than be a taxi driver, he will drive some part of the country and interview somebody about something interesting that's going on. Like, for example, we've got a massive public outcry about fracking, with battles going on the streets down in Sussex, just south of London. And there's all sorts of this. Frankie Boyle, who's a famous guy who's gone on strike, hunger strike in sympathy with those in Guantanamo Bay, and all sorts of interesting stuff. So the Artist Taxi Driver is a good one to watch. He's a kind of... He's not quite as sophisticated, I would say, as Luke, but he has a very interesting approach. He's not content in just driving his cab around London. Yeah. Every once in a while, he just whacks off to one other part of the country, finds some people, and interviews them.
Well, that's great. That takes individuals reaching out and doing things. Hey, we thank you very much this evening for the interview. And
thanks very much, George. Lovely to hear from you.
Good luck on everything over there. God bless.